This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Yesterday, an Atlas V rocket lifted off from Cape Canaveral in Florida, carrying a space probe named OSIRIS-REx. And if all goes well, it will be coming back again in about 7 years with a sample from an asteroid. It's going to land on an asteroid, pick some stuff up. Here, well, that's exciting. Let's talk about it with Amy Nordrum. She's an associate editor at the IEEE Spectrum in New York. Welcome back, Amy.
Thanks, Ira.
Tell me about this. Sounds cool.
It is cool. So
very geeky.
It is, absolutely. So this is a mission to an asteroid. The asteroid is called Bennu, and NASA is headed there to take a look at what is known as a primitive asteroid. So this asteroid will tell us a lot about the origins of the solar system. When the solar system first formed about 4.5 billion years ago, this asteroid formed along with it, and it has pretty much remained intact since that time. So this, hopefully, by taking a few rock samples from the surface of Bennu and bringing it back here around 2023, the NASA scientists will get a better idea and a better look into what the original composition of the solar system might have been.
Is there any fear that this asteroid might hit Earth as it travels?
There is. So this asteroid is actually passing within relatively close range of Earth, as well as far as asteroids go, about every 6 years. And then there's going to be an event in about 2135 where the asteroid will pass within the moon's orbit. And we're not really sure how this could change the orbit of the asteroid itself, but by taking a little bit of a better look at the asteroid's orbit today and understanding how the reflection of the sun and the absorption of heat and the thrust that provides to the asteroid today, that will help them also get an idea of how that orbit might change in 2135, which could give us clues as to whether or not it's actually going to ever run into the Earth.
And hopefully by then we'll have some way of changing orbits of asteroids. They don't hit us.
Maybe we'll be able to intercept it and send Bennu on its way. We hope so.
All right. Let's move on to Apple unveiling the next generation of their iPhones. Nobody expected a whole lot, did they? It's kind of a quiet lead up to it.
So Apple hasn't made a lot of dramatic changes. I mean, the iPhone was first released in 2007, and there have been certainly changes and upgrades over the years and the generations. The big news this time around, when the iPhone 7 was announced on Wednesday, is that you will no longer have a headphone jack. The traditional analog audio jack that we've all relied on to plug in our headphones is gone from the new model. So what you'll do instead is you'll use the Lightning port, which is currently the port that you're using to charge your iPhone. You'll actually have to have new headphones that plug into that port, which Apple is going to ship with every new iPhone.
Yeah.
But this caused a little bit of controversy among longtime Apple customers.
Well, you know, the iPhone, the jack goes back like over 50 years. It's the same size as my old transistor radio. So it was actually the biggest part, the thickest part, in holding it back from getting any skinnier.
Right, absolutely. So Apple's argument here is that customers are going to be better off in the end because the analog output wasn't that great at transferring power, whereas the digital Lightning port can do that very well. And what that allows is for you to create things like headphones that can do have more functionality along with the sound. So in addition to producing sound, they can also do things like maybe monitor your heart rate or your activity level while you work out. You can expect more and more powerful headphones to come along eventually.
Yeah. That's exciting, though. And there'll be, I'm sure, other people have already wireless headphones.
Wireless headphones, competitors.
Right.
And even a couple of Chinese manufacturers have already eliminated that headphone jack, so you can expect others to follow.
Hit the road, Jack.
Hey!
So there's news this week about that. Nanoparticles in the brain, right?
Right. So there's a couple of researchers from the University of Lancaster who have taken a couple of brain samples from both Lancaster and Mexico City, and they've analyzed these brain samples for magnetic particles. And then they've taken a look at what exactly magnetic particles have made their way into the brain. And what they found there was magnetite nanoparticles. And these are particles that are some of which are originally produced in the brain. They tend to be spiky when the brain itself is producing these nanoparticles. But they're also present in air pollution, and those particles tend to be more spherical. And so for the first time, these researchers have found spherical magnetite nanoparticles in the brain, which they believe made their way there through the nose cavity and into the brain from air pollution. So this is possibly a reason to be concerned.
And we don't know what the long-term effects of these things.
No, we don't. We do know that the magnetite nanoparticles that are present in the brain biologically, naturally, the researcher I spoke with, she has a theory that they're enveloped in possibly like a biological membrane that keeps them somewhat benign. But the magnetite nanoparticles that actually you're breathe in through your nose potentially, they would not have that protective membrane that she theorizes is there. So they might actually be causing more problems and things like free radicals that may or may not be linked to neurodegenerative diseases. They're going to be following up on some of that research.
Wow, that's kind of a little scary there. And also finally, there's this breaking Bandicoot news. Breaking, just in. Tell us what that is.
So the bandicoot is this small marsupial that's found in Australia and Tasmania. And some researchers were curious about the fact that, for some reason, the bandicoots in Australia seem to be pretty good at avoiding domestic dogs. They stayed out of the yards when there was a dog nearby. But the ones in Tasmania they found weren't so great at that. So they were wondering, well, you know, why would the bandicoots in Australia pretty much know to avoid dogs, but the ones in Tasmania aren't afraid of them? And the answer, they think, is that dingoes have long preceded dogs in their presence in both Australia and Tasmania, and dingoes look a lot like dogs. In fact, they're thought to be evolved from the domesticated dog that has gone wild in that area, come down from Asia. So their theory is that since dingoes are present in Australia and not in Tasmania, there's been this really interesting case of coevolution, where the bandicoots that are preyed upon by dingoes in Australia are much more accustomed to dog-like features or dog smells or something, and they know to avoid those yards, whereas those in Tasmania have never had that privilege.
So how long do they go back?
So dogs have been there about 200 years, and dingoes have been there about 4,000. And cats have only been there for 200 also, and pretty much all the bandicoots are pretty bad at avoiding cats, so that's like a brand new challenge for them to be able to figure out.
Avoiding the cats.
Right.
So are they lunch for cats?
They can be, yeah. So they will definitely, the bandicoots are preyed upon by dogs, cats, dingoes. It's tough to be a bandicoot.
Yeah, I guess it is. It's not tough to be Amy Nordrum, because she knows a lot of stuff. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks, Ira.
Amy Nordrum, Associate Editor of IEEE Spectrum here in New York. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. And here's something you might not have known. Seaweed farms are doing brisk business. Demand for seaweed as food is growing, but so is its use in skincare products, industrial adhesives, and even landscaping. The industry was worth more than $6 billion in 2014, and farms of cultivated seaweed continue to spread off the coasts, like China and Korea and Indonesia and many other countries. So where am I going with this? Well, there's some good and some bad news in this story, and a new report from scientists with the United Nations University have some warnings for the burgeoning industry. The lead author of their report is my guest, Elizabeth Katira-Cook, is a marine biologist with the Scottish Association of Marine Science, head of the UN University Associate Institute in Scotland. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on your program.
You're welcome. Let's talk about this. How do you farm seaweed to begin with?
Okay. Well, typically you kind of stretch some lines out and you buoy them so they're sort of floating on the surface of the sea. And then you have other lines that are hanging sort of vertically down from beneath that, in which you attach your tiny, tiny little sporelings, your tiny plants. You attach them maybe in your nursery or hatchery, and then you put it out to sea, and then they grow into these beautiful, long seaweed plants.
Dr. Katira-Cook, who is benefiting from seaweed farming?
Of course, many countries such as Korea and Japan and China, Indonesia, Philippines, all of these countries have been benefited from seaweed farming for hundreds of years. And they're doing very, very well. And it provides these kind of very poor rural communities with an excellent income. Of course, in the last 10 years, though, there's been more and more countries in developed nations, in Canada, America, Scotland even, that have kind of cottoned on that, you know, seaweed production could actually be quite profitable, and there's more and more interest in growing seaweeds in these more developed countries. So, there's quite a lot of interest, and that's one of the reasons why it's grown so much over the last 50 years.
Well, it seems like everybody can grow seaweed then and make some money and feed and make all kinds of products from that seaweed. What's the bad side about this?
Okay. So, over the last few years, and this is something that really sparked this report that came out just earlier this week. So, you know, the seaweeds, that are being grown. There's one in particular, Kappa ficus, which is from sort of Indonesia and the Philippines area, that's now grown in over 30 countries around the world. And this one particular seaweed, it's really easy. You just propagate it like you would some of your plants. You just take a cutting, and then you can move that cutting to any place in the world. But of course, where it's likely to grow, where the temperatures are right, of course. But of course, along with those plants, you can also take disease. You can also take hitchhikers, like pests and pathogens, and we call them invasive, non-indigenous species. So you can take these along with you. And one of the countries, the Philippines, just between 2011 and 2013, it lost $310 million just in that two-year period through disease, a disease called the ice disease, which is a bacterial infection. So, you know, there are these downsides of cultivation, which have been seen in other industries. And, you know, and this is the purpose of this report, was to pretty much what lessons can be learned from other industries that we can apply to the seaweed. So,
Well, what does the ice attack? When you say, oh, they've lost all this money from what?
Yeah, it's the actual seaweed itself.
It's seaweed itself.
So if you looked at the seaweed, it looks like parts of the frond and parts of the seaweed have actually turned to ice. It loses its color, it loses its red coloration. It just turns very sort of opaque white and dies. And you can lose your entire crop very quickly because, of course, it's just a clone. It's just one, you know, it's got the same genetic makeup throughout the entire farm. So one plant gets infected, that's it. There's no resistance.
So you need more biodiversity in the seaweed then?
Yeah, absolutely, and that's one of the recommendations that we really call for, as well as sort of improved biosecurity on your farm, is actually to produce far more cultivars of the seaweed, so different genetic makeups, so you have kind of seed banks ready, so if a farm fails, you're ready to supply it with a new cultivar, the same species, but of a different, you know, slightly different genetic makeup that may well be resistant to that disease.
Dr. Cartier-Cook, thank you for taking time to be with us today. Elizabeth Cartier-Cook is a marine biologist with the Scottish Association of Marine Science. We're going to take a break and come back and talk about hearing loss and the research into building a better cochlear implants. So keep listening. Support for Science Friday comes from Casper. Casper is a sleep brand offering obsessively engineered mattresses at a very fair price. It combines springy latex and supportive memory foams to create an award-winning sleep surface with just the right sink and just the right bounce. Time magazine named it one of the best inventions of 2015. Casper sells directly to consumers, eliminating commission-driven inflated prices. Mattresses can often cost well over $1,500, while Casper starts at just $500 for a twin-size mattress. And you can try Casper for 100 nights risk-free in your own home. And if you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. Casper understands the importance of truly sleeping on a mattress before you commit, especially considering you're going to spend a third of your life on it. Best of all, Casper mattresses are made right here in America. And now Science Friday listeners can get $50 toward any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/scifry and entering promo code scifry. That's casper.com/scifry, promo code scifry. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. That's an approximation of what you might hear if you were trying to listen to a conversation while relying on a cochlear implant to hear. Could you make out the spoken words above all that background noise? Yeah, me neither. Cochlear implants are an increasingly useful tool for people who have had hearing loss, so complete that they can't be helped by hearing aids, but they do have some drawbacks, like electrical interference that can make it harder to pick out words, and they have trouble filtering background noise from useful conversations, just like that little sample we heard. That brings us to our story. Picture that you're studying to be an audiologist and ironically relying on an implant to connect you to the world. That was the situation in which Vanderbilt audiologist Allie Sisler Dinwiddie found herself after a car accident took away her hearing midway through graduate school. Emily Driscoll, a science documentary producer here in New York, tells Allie's story and premieres our new video series about scientists who have overcome challenges to do their work. Welcome back, Emily. Good to see
you. Thanks. Thank you.
Also here to talk more about the research that's making implants more useful to people like Allie is Renee Gifford. Dr. Gifford is an associate professor of hearing and speech sciences at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee, and she's joining us on the phone. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Emily, first, congratulations on the start of this. This is a great new series. Tell us about Breakthrough, it's called, right?
Yeah, it's really exciting. It's been over a year in the works, and Luke Groskin and I produced it. It's called Breakthrough, Portraits of Women in Science, and it's six films that follow scientists across STEM fields, and the films reveal the personal stories of these scientists as well as the cutting edge and in innovative research that they're working on. And we really want to show, what is it like to be a scientist? What are the difficulties and the challenges, but then also the excitements and rewards of what it's like to be a scientist? Mm-hmm. And we follow different kinds of researchers, like one whose work takes her to very harsh conditions in the Arctic. We also have a portrait of one woman who studies sneezes and how snot breaks up in sneezes to understand the fluid dynamics of disease transmission. Mm-hmm. And the next episode takes us to ISRO, which is the Indian version of NASA.
Wow. Yeah. Let's talk about your first video. The first video tells us the story of an audiologist who persevered through hearing loss.
Yes, the first episode premieres today, and it's called A Resounding Remedy, and it follows audiologists Allie Sisler Dinwiddie and Renee Gifford at Vanderbilt. And they have a really unique situation because Allie was studying hearing sciences, and here she was in her graduate work when she got into a car accident and it plunged her world into silence. So she was thinking, you know, how do I help people hear when I myself can't even hear? So she ended up getting a cochlear implant, which restored some of her hearing, and she was able to work again. But then she was in a very unique situation in which her colleague, Renee Gifford, became basically her doctor, because Renee was working on this with this interdisciplinary team on this way to improve cochlear implants, and Allie was one of the first test subjects.
Mm-hmm. All right, we actually have a little bit of a clip from the video, and this is where Allie describes how implants changed her access to the world.
When I got my first cochlear implant, I went from nothing to a world that's so far beyond what my hearing aids were ever able to provide. And I had no idea how much I missed growing up. No idea.
Dr. Gifford, Allie already had hearing aids. How is a cochlear implant different than hearing aids?
Yeah, that's a great question. So cochlear implants are really designed for people who have more severe hearing losses. So those who, despite using appropriately fitted hearing aids, are really struggling for communication in everyday life.
This is where your story and Dr. Sisler Dinwiddie's intersect. You're working on how disabling parts of the implant, ironically, if you disable part of it, you can actually improve the hearing of people?
That's absolutely right. It's almost sort of a scientific less is more.
Yeah.
So we're basically taking certain electrodes and deactivating them in an effort to try to reduce some of the electrical interference that we see with cochlear implants.
So how do you know which electrodes might need to be turned off?
Yeah, so what we're using is we're using imaging to help guide us. So we use preoperative as well as postoperative CT images. And we basically will build a 3D reconstruction of their internal auditory system. And by having that preoperative CT scan, we're able to have a nice artifact-free image. And then we can sort of superimpose the postoperative CT scan when the electrode array is in place, along with, of course, the metallic artifact that we see because of the implanted electrode array. And then we can actually measure discrete distances between each of those implanted electrodes and the actual auditory neurons that we're trying to stimulate. It's basically just simple distances.
Emily, why did you choose this story? What made her story so compelling?
the innovative research that they're working on and the fact that hearing is so complex to begin with. And look, we're putting an electrode array down into our cochlea and stimulating nerve cells. It was just so, and then turning off some of those electrodes was fascinating. But then I don't know if you've ever seen an activation or someone getting their cochlear implants turned on online, but it's such an emotional, powerful thing to see people hearing again, some of them hearing for the first time. And we were able to see this, Renee, we were able to be there for an activation. Yeah. So that's one of the most powerful parts in the film.
Exciting.
And then Allie's story as well.
Renee, exciting to you too?
Oh, so exciting. It's one of the best things I get to do. It's truly a pleasure.
In video, we see when she gets her cochlear implants activated for the first time and crying when she hears her parents' voices.
Yeah, that was one of the most special parts, because she actually, when she was talking to Renee, she just kind of didn't have much of a reaction. But then Renee said, turn around and talk to your parents. And then she remembered, she said, you sound the same. She remembered how they sounded.
Wow. Gives you great feeling, Renee, to be involved in this research, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely.
How does hearing loss or impairment usually happen, Dr. Gifford? Tell us, where does it happen in our ear? In most cases, what's going on?
Yeah, so great question. From the adult perspective, the vast majority of hearing losses are what we would consider unknown. We probably believe that a majority of them are due to genetic, reasons, but because we don't understand all of the underlying genetic mechanisms that potentially, contribute to hearing loss, we don't fully understand exactly what's causing this. Of course, environmental factors, including noise exposure, toxins in our environment, taking, for example, medications that may be toxic to the auditory system. These are all things also that can cause hearing loss. Typically, what we do see, however, is that it's the actual structures within the cochlea itself. So the cochlea is a snail-shaped organ that actually sort of lives inside the temporal bone. So it's the side bone of the side of our head, and it's the strongest bone in the body. And within that cochlea, there are these very delicate, what they're called, hair cells. And over time, with damage of whatever type of damage it might be, those hair cells will ultimately become dysfunctional and then ultimately die. And those hair cells are the primary means by which that incoming sound that hits our ear and it hits our eardrum are transduced to the auditory nerve. So when those cells start to die off, there's really absolutely no way to completely transmit that sound to the auditory brain.
Yeah. Well, Emily, I want to thank you for the new video. It's a great video. It's you can check it out in our Breakthrough series on our website at sciencefriday.com/hearing. I'm going to let you go because I know you're about to fly to India for our next video.
Yep.
Can you give us a hint, a little bit of a hint?
Sure. It's really exciting. We're going to ISRO, the Indian Space Agency, and we're going to see what it's like to work on their first interplanetary mission.
Wow. So have a good trip.
Thank you.
Safe trip. Emily Driscoll, science documentary producer based here in New York. Dr. Gifford, let's talk a little bit more about your research and the progress of cochlear implants. How do you know when you should have one?
Yeah, so it's not a cut and dry answer for everyone. We tend to say once someone is no longer able to, say, talk on the phone without visual cues, whether it be, texting or a caption type of telephone, or when someone is completely reliant on visual cues for communication, that's a really good indication that someone has progressed to the point where they might be a candidate for an implant.
And what will it do that the hearing aid can't do? I mean, is it mostly for people who have the hair cell loss? Are most people are going to get eligible for that?
Absolutely. So I explained to my own patients that, we could provide them with the world's most expensive hearing aid, the very best technology, but it's almost as if trying to play music through a broken speaker. Hmm. We can amplify the sound and we can shape the sound, but the ear is not capable of transducing that sound to the auditory nerve and then ultimately up to the auditory cortex.
Mm-hmm. I know one of your big projects is bilateral hearing, how an implant could work with a small amount of retained hearing ability. How could these two work together?
Yeah, so I do focus primarily on it's the combination of electric and acoustic hearing. So the electric hearing through the cochlear implant itself, which is just actually stimulation of the auditory nerve through those electrical pulses, as combined with the natural acoustic hearing of our own ear, which is basically just referring to, you know, the sound pressure waves hitting the external ear and eardrum and propagating through the auditory system. And basically what happens is when you can combine those two very distinctly different modalities of hearing, they can combine to provide the synergistic tremendous improvement in not only sound quality, but also in speech understanding in quiet as well as in noise.
Mm-hmm. So we actually can compare. We have a little audio demonstration here to compare how that might sound. Let's first hear what it might sound like to hear with a cochlear implant with background noise. Wow, you can hardly hear the conversation going on. There is a conversation going on, and I want to show you that. We also have a simulation of preserved normal hearing, at least in registers below 500 hertz. So, Dr. Gifford, what's the difference? How is it working better there?
Yeah, so you probably immediately could tell that it just sounded more natural. Mm-hmm. You could actually kind of almost extract out the talker's voice from the presence of that background noise. So by adding even a very small amount of acoustic hearing, and I'm talking about acoustic hearing that if presented in isolation would give you really essentially no intelligibility whatsoever. But when you combine that with that electric signal, you're able to really essentially extract out the portions of that talker's voice that makes it sound like natural, you know, natural speech, and allows us to really truly extract that speech in the presence of the background noise.
So, but if you have some sort of residual hearing left over, isn't that kind of risky then to go through surgery to have a cochlear implant if you can still hear something?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly could be. We're in a much different place today than we were even just 5-10 years ago. So with advances in surgical techniques and advances in more atraumatic electrode arrays, we're actually seeing tremendous amounts of hearing preservation, even in the, you know, in the implanted ear. Mm. And so what I mean by that is that if an individual has relatively decent low frequency hearing or you know, hearing in the low pitches, even by surgically implanting electrode array in that ear, it's very possible to preserve that low frequency hearing. And then you can combine that electric and acoustic hearing, not only across ears, but within the implanted ear as well.
Yeah. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking with Dr. Renee Gifford of Vanderbilt. The big question, the money question. Everybody asks about money. Okay, so there are cochlear implants. Are they affordable? Will Medicare pay for them? Medicaid? How can you get one?
Great question. So Medicare does currently provide coverage for cochlear implantation. Of course, the patient does need to meet the criteria, which currently is up to 40% correct on sentences presented in an auditory-only condition with hearing aids. Medicaid's a little trickier. As you know, Medicaid is actually on a state-by-state basis. For children now, all states will provide cochlear implantation for state Medicaid. But for adults, so once someone reaches the age of 21, there are some states that just will not provide cochlear implantation coverage, such as the state in which I live, Tennessee.
Is that right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Does Obamacare or corporate care, you know, health insurance cover it?
Most generally, however, each of those, each of those policies under the Affordable Care Act are different somewhat, and some of them actually have some exclusions. So, of course, you know, based on affordability, you might choose more of a discount policy, for example. And there are sometimes very, exclusions that would exclude cochlear implantation entirely.
But it's important.
So you have to be careful.
Yeah, but you feel that it's important to get kids, young kids, to have these things, the implant.
Absolutely. And the earlier, the better. I mean, there are just mounds of data showing that the earlier, even younger than 1 year of age, you can yield, you know, very normal speech and language development with, of course, appropriate speech and language intervention.
What makes hearing such a crucial field of research in your mind and why you're involved in it?
Oh, I from day one of my life, I remember that hearing was an issue. So I was raised by my grandparents, and my grandfather was a World War II veteran, and he actually was a Purple Heart recipient. He had been shot down. He was a paratrooper, and he had been shot down. And from that point forward, he had a very severe to profound hearing loss, but it was really only in the higher pitches. So he was one of these individuals who tried hearing aids and just really never derived any benefit. And so I knew from the time I was, you know, in diapers that you communication was vital and you had to look at someone and you had to talk. And so from my entire life, hearing and communication has been so tremendously important.
Is there any, you know, I'm going to give you the blank check question. If you had a blank check to advance technology or come up with an improvement, what would you like to have in cochlear ear implants?
Wow, that's I'll tell you right now, the current technology is pretty remarkable because what really is happening is the brain is taking this very rather crude signal and is making it and changing it in ways that we never ever thought possible. So if I had a blank check, I would not necessarily apply changes in technology to today, but I would actually want to make this technology available to every person around the world who actually needed it, because that really is the issue. There are places in the world where this technology is absolutely inaccessible due to funding purposes.
Yeah, sounds like a good mission, Dr. Gifford. Thank you very much for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
Renee Gifford, Associate Professor of Hearing and Speech Science at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to take a visit afterwards to a vineyard and explore some of the strange sensory tricks your mind can play on you when you're sipping wine. The Iron Horse Vineyard out there in California was a host for us, and we tasted some wine. And here are the results when we get back, so stay with us. Hard to believe that Science Friday's first broadcast was 25 years ago. That's right, this is our silver anniversary. And to commemorate our amazing journey, we're hosting a gala event on October 15th at the Intrepid Sea, Air, and Space Museum here in New York City. It'll be a celebration of everything we've done for the past 25 years with special guests like Alan Alda, Brian Greene, and more. And you are invited. So head over to sciencefriday.com/gala to find out more and to reserve your ticket. You don't want to miss this. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. As you may know, if you're a regular listener to the show, we're celebrating Science Friday's 25th birthday this year. And in fact, it was 25 years ago this week that we got our staff together and started to make the program Science Friday. As part of that anniversary celebration, last month I took a trip to the Iron Horse Vineyards in Sonoma, California, where my mission, it's a tough one, was to taste 8 different blends of the same sparkling wine and pick my favorite for a special Sci-Fry bottling. Here's a little taste of our visit to Iron Horse Vineyards with David Muscard and Joy Sterling.
Science is very important in winemaking, but most important is the craft of winemaking, and that's something that you only learn by doing or by observing, and certainly working with somebody that's done it for a number of years.
And how long have you been doing this?
I believe it's 36 years, 20 years here at Iron Horse. You know, you lose count after a while. And my name is David Muscard. I'm the winemaker at Iron Horse Vineyards. That is my lucky task in life. And we're standing in the middle of one of our most beautiful Pinot Noir vineyards, and this will be used for making a beautiful red table wine. This is actually a grape press. So if you look up, you'll see a hopper up there. The grapes will, like a giant funnel. So all these bins of grapes will be funneled through that. You ought to pop one in your mouth.
It doesn't taste like Concord grapes like you expect, you know, or like that we get in the store. It's very sweet.
It is sweet, yet it has a nice bracing acidity that gives it a cleansing on the palate as well. And it's just plain yummy. Inside this room is where we do the final steps in the sparkling wine making production. Bottling is relatively simple. We'll have the wine, we'll have extra yeast, and we'll have extra sugar. And we're expecting that fermentation to all take place inside the confines of a champagne bottle.
Okay, so now we're gonna go down and taste.
We are. We can't put this off any longer.
Do you want me to help pour?
Absolutely. So if you look down at your sheet, wine number one is the 2012 Blanc de Noir Cuvée that we have added, in that case, 8 milliliters of Blanc de Blanc Lex, 4 milliliters of a brightly colored red wine. We also added on the next wine some Pinot Noir. So each glass has some variations in these different items that we're going to be adding. You follow that?
So it's the same three items, but just in different proportions.
That's right. Yeah. So now what we need to do is just simply get to business.
All right. Wine number one. Tastes good. One is a little stronger than two. Three is good too. This is a tough business. By the time I get to four, I may not care.
Did you purposely add that color effect to influence the outcome?
Sure. It sets the stage. If this was in a dark glass and you couldn't see, your brain wouldn't be working on that. You would just simply go on what it smells like and then what it tastes like. But you can't help it as a human being to start thinking about what that wine is going to smell and then taste like. Ira, have you come up with something?
In judging the different glasses here, what my final judge was the flavor, but it was also which one would I'd like to have more of? And that's the one I wound up picking, which was the number seven on our list.
Starting with wine number one, going on through wine number eight, I was giving you variations on a similar theme. And I think we've chosen a wine that will fit beautifully with fall foods and the whole fall experience.
You should cheers to that.
We
cheers to that. I finished mine.
Yeah, and I finished mine too. And all eight, almost through eight of those glasses. Somebody had to do it, right? Well, it really was a true test of senses, let me tell you. And as you heard, lots of sensory factors, like the color, can influence the choice of wine. Color can influence our sense of smell and taste. And subtle changes in environment with the glassware itself might make all the difference between liking or disliking a glass of wine. And now that we have wet your palate a bit, let's talk about some of those sensory phenomena that can occur when sipping wine. With Charles Spence, he's a professor of experimental psychology, University of Oxford in the UK, and head of the Crossmodal Research Laboratory there. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi there.
You're welcome. Dr. Spence, in that piece that we heard, the winemaker was talking about adding a little bit of red wine to his sparkling wines to give it that pink blush color. Does that really change your brain? Does it prime it?
Most certainly does.
Yeah.
I guess whenever in everyday drinking and tasting, we're always going to see the wine before we put it to our lips, the glass to our lips. And our brain can't help but kind of predict or make expectations about the likely taste, aroma, flavor, bouquet of what's to come. And so those expectations kind of anchor our experience when we do taste. In a way, it's almost like we're not actually tasting. We're kind of occasionally comparing our experience to what we expected. And if what we taste isn't so different from what we expected based on the color and any other cues, then we kind of live in this world of our expectations and never quite update enough for the actual experience that we have.
I want to invite our listeners to ask if they have any questions about wine, our number, if you'd like to phone us in. Let me get the paper with the number on 844-724-8255, as if I should know it by now, right? 844-724-8255 is our number. This idea of the color, the taste, and whatever, do we have an evolutionary reason for some of those cues?
I guess it's sort of yes, in the sense that what kind of world would we be in if we had to put everything to our lips to taste it in order to know whether it was nutritious or poisonous or not. So our brains kind of learnt to make predictions and say, okay, I've learnt that when I see kind of a ripe red fruit colour, it's probably going to be sweet. Mm-hmm. When I see something that's green, probably it's unripe, maybe sour, less nutritious. If I can make those predictions, then I can, I'm in a better place to know which trees to climb for the nutritious fruits and what else to eat. So we're always trying to make these predictions, what correlates with nutritional qualities in food and drink, and use those predictions in order to kind of sort of second guess or anticipate what we should consume.
One of those relations you've done experiments with, you've gotten people to drink wine under different colored lighting. Did that really make a difference?
It really did. So I think in what might be the world's biggest experiential, experimental wine tasting. We had about 3,000, a little over 3,000 people in the South Bank Centre, underneath the South Bank Centre in London, back in this May Bank Holiday of 2014. And we gave them all a glass of red wine, a Rioja, in a black tasting glass, so you couldn't see the colour. And then we asked them, people, to rate the wine, saying how fruity or fresh, how much they liked it. Initially under just regular white lighting you might have at home. And then we changed the lighting to red, then we changed it to green, each time asking people, what does it taste like now? And then added in some music into the background as well, sweet and sour music. And what we were able to show were those 3,000 kind of regular drinkers, not wine experts as such, that we could get about a 15 to 20% change in people's perception of the fruitiness or freshness of the wine, or how much they liked it, simply as a function of the background illumination in the room in which they were tasting.
So wine bars probably know this, you would think, that they should have a certain kind of lighting and music.
And there is a certain sense in which intuitively sometimes designers, experienced designers, may pick up on these things and incorporate them, not necessarily knowing why, or sometimes feeling a bit kind of embarrassed that, you know, why should the room lighting change the taste of what people order? Why should the music playing in the background change what people say? And yet it does. So it's kind of our job in a way to test those intuitions, provide evidence that for those that really do matter, and some other things that we think that should matter actually turn out not to. And it's kind of bizarre in a way that those background colours do make a difference, but in that sort of tasting environment with a black tasting glass, if all you've got is a red lighting, that primes all sorts of notions for us about sweetness, and that then again anchors the tasting experience. And when we had the winemakers who came to the Colour Lab, this event, they were the kind of real experts, and you think, well, they would not be affected by the background colour. They can just identify what is in the glass and the taste and the bouquet. And yet they were coming away saying, wow, we need to know about this, and we need to change our kind of cellar door experience in order to deliver a different kind of experience for those who come to our wineries.
Interesting caller. Let's go to Denise in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hi, Denise.
Hi there. I have a question, and I'll admit I did step away from my radio for a moment, so you may have covered this, but I am blind, and I wondered what effect that has on my perception of taste. Am I just missing a spectrum of taste, or do I maybe taste things more accurately without that visual preconceived notion?
I suppose it depends in a way on when, whether you were born blind, congenitally blind, or became blind later in life.
Mm-hmm. And what would that difference be?
So those who have never seen may not have the kind of visual imagery that those who, say, become blind later in life. For a number of years after people become blind, they can still imagine what things look like, what their partners look like, and it can be that mental imagery that does much of the work. Much in the same way, I suppose, that you see there are kind of these dine-in-the-dark restaurants that are attempting, in some cases, to try and capture the experience of the blind. If you lose sight, does that mean that your other senses are more acute, you attend more to taste and smell? Perhaps, but again, it sort of depends on how long from when the vision is lost. And even those of us who go to a dine-in-the-dark restaurant, say, and try a glass of wine that we cannot see, nevertheless, our mind might be making images of what we think that wine, from its temperature, from its bouquet, what I think it looks like.
Hmm. Let's talk about, now that we've talked about vision, what about sound? You've done experiments in how sound affects the wine drinking experience, and we have two clips here of two different sparkling wines. Let's hear the first one. I'm getting thirsty just now. And the next one. Boy, they were different. They really they were different. What makes them different, Charles?
So I think sound is often talked about as the forgotten flavor sense. We think about things, what things taste like and what they smell like, maybe even the sight of them in the case of the white and the red wine. But the sound of things, that's something we never really think about. And yet I think it's key to our experience of flavor. And again, even when somebody pours something in front of us, from the sound of the pouring, we can tell so much about what's in the glass. We can tell perhaps the temperature, is something hot or cold? Those sound different. We can even tell the kind of carbonation. This is something that you find wine writers intuitively talking about. They say they love the sound of the bubbles in a fancy champagne. It's just not the same in a Cava or in a soda water. and our research online with sounds just like the ones you played demonstrate that we really can tell the difference between different kinds of carbonation. We have an appreciation, a preference for, I think for mine was the second one rather than the first. It felt sort of creamier somehow.
Yeah, well, the first one was a flute glass, and the second one was a wider glass. And I guess it matters how the bubbles get distributed, and the sound bounces around too.
Sure, sure. Different kinds of carbonation too. So I think from the sounds of pouring, as we heard, you can tell something about the temperature. You can tell something about perhaps the glass size. You can tell something about the kind of drink that's been poured in, maybe even the viscosity. All that information is there. We never really think about it because we always have, normally we can see the wine, and yet our brain picks up on those cues, and they too can subtly change our expectations.
I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Dr. Charles Spence of Oxford. Let's talk about the cap. You know, when you bring a bottle of wine in and you unscrew the cap rather than pop the cork, aren't you already at a disadvantage just from seeing that happen?
From seeing that happen or from hearing that happen, because it's very distinctively different sounds of the pop of the cork and the crack of the screw cap. And this is something that does set expectations too. And once you've heard those sounds or you've seen what kind of bottle closure was used, you cannot unsee it or unhear it, and that will set expectations. That, if I could give you a completely blind taste test, the chances are the majority of consumers, just social drinkers or even wine experts, would prefer, if anything, the screw top. And yet, when we hear the closure, when we see the closure being opened, we all have a preference, or many of us have a preference for the cork stopper bottle.
Right. What about the bottle itself? The size, the shape, the color, does that influence what we think about the wine?
Well, most certainly it does. The one thing we've been most interested in over the last couple of years is, again, following up on some of the comments you find in some of the wine press about some of these sort of new world producers who are delivering their wines, mostly all of the 750 milliliters, but in bottles that are so heavy that in fact sometimes you find wine waiters now in restaurants, you know, coming, when you've picked a wine from the list, they'll bring the bottle to the table and say, feel that, sir. Just feel the quality. You made a good choice tonight. And that's all about the weight of the bottle. And when we've tested, evaluated the 600 or 700 bottles in the Oxford wine store, just down the road from where I am tonight, what you find is that for every extra pound you pay, you get 8 extra grams of glass. And that now we find there are some producers out there who are making bottles that maybe are 2.25 kilograms of glass when the wine is emptied compared to others where it's just less than a kilo full of wine. So a huge difference there. And some are accentuating, almost caricaturing the weight by deepening the punt, by thickening the glass, by raising the shoulders in order to convey a notion of quality.
Can you take a very bad quality wine and make people think it's a good quality by how you bottle it and glass? So,
that is the question, isn't it? When you come around to my house, what should you bring? I think there are limits, certainly here, and some of the latest neuroscience and neuroimaging research, when you look at which parts of the brain light up when experts and social drinkers are given wine that you tell them that's expensive or cheap, it turns out there are limits, and that maybe, you know, mid-price wines can be shifted all over the place. But what do you call it? Two-buck chuck. You might have a bigger challenge just by putting it in a heavy bottle. You might convince some, but I think not all.
I think we'll leave it right there, Dr. Spence. Charles Spence, Professor of Experimental Psychology, University of Oxford in the UK, and head of the Cross-Modal Research Laboratory there. Very interesting. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Pleasure.
And also thanks to Jamie Good, author of the book I Taste Red. And check it out if you're a wine and science geek. It helped us with a lot of our research. Quick correction before we go. Earlier in the program, we were talking about some breaking Bandicoot news, remember, at the top? And we gave the impression, I think, that Australia and Tasmania were two separate countries. We know they're not. All you folks listening to us in Australia, Tasmania, we know, is actually an island state of Australia. Charles Berquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor, Katie Eiler. Lou Graskin is our video producer. Rich Kim, our technical director. And Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz are engineers at the controls at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. You can email us, send us stuff, anything you'd like. Well, not anything you'd like, to scifry@science.com.